Rocking the cradle, shaking the ground. Rocking the cradle, shaking the ground. In 2014, two significant opportunities emerged, each promising to expand our presence and deepen our community impact. The first came from Coram's Fields, a unique 7-acre children's sanctuary nestled in the heart of Bloomsbury, London. Established in 1936 on the historic grounds of the former Foundling Hospital, Britain's first home for abandoned children, founded by Thomas Coram in 1739, Coram's Fields has long been a haven where no adult can enter without a child, ensuring a safe and inclusive environment. Octavia, the director of Coram's Fields, approached us with a vision to enhance the park's offerings. Collaborating closely, we began crafting plans to integrate a cafe that would complement the park's ethos, providing refreshments to families while respecting the site's historical significance. Simultaneously, we secured a new contract with Reigate and Banstead Council, encompassing the operation of two prominent park cafes, the Pavilion in Memorial Park, Redhill, and the expansive Glass Cafe in Priory Park, Reigate. As our existing contract at Lady Neville Recreation Ground in Banstead was nearing its end, Steve McLeod, the council's project manager, graciously included it under the same agreement, a testament to the council's satisfaction with our services. Under this new contract, Steve introduced key performance indicators, KPIs, to ensure consistent quality across all sites, with particular emphasis on Priory Park, the council's flagship park. The park buzzed with activity. Weekly park runs, daily military fitness classes led by an ex-serviceman named Paul, and a steady stream of visitors. However, from the outset, Paul seemed to harbor a dislike for pistachios in the park. Whether it was personal or due to an allegiance with the previous cafe operator, Urban Kitchens, remained unclear. Upon taking over the concessions, we faced the daunting task of overhauling the existing facilities. The kitchen areas and main cafe spaces required complete refurbishment. As per our usual practice, Martin, Fred, and our new team member Jason, a skilled builder and saxophonist with the Jiven instructors, led the fit out. During the demolition of the old counters and units, we uncovered a shocking infestation of cockroaches. They were everywhere, a silent testament to years of neglect. It was astonishing that such a severe issue had gone unnoticed. We immediately contacted Rentokil and Reigate's Environmental Services, Russell Jenner, and of course, Steve McLeod to address the problem. Despite these challenges, our commitment to creating welcoming, community-focused spaces remained unwavering. Each obstacle reinforced our dedication to excellence and our belief in the power of community engagement. For our new venture at Coram's Fields, we brought in someone we already knew, Bylan, a spirited local from Broccoli, not far from our Hillyfields Cafe. Bylan had flair. She was a trained barista who freelanced for Gaggia at trade shows, dazzling crowds with her precision pours and deep knowledge of espresso. But she wasn't just about coffee. Bylan was also a talented cook who loved hosting and had long expressed interest in joining our franchise, asking us more than once to keep her in mind if an opportunity came up. So, when Coram's Fields presented itself, Adrian and I knew she could be a strong fit. We introduced her to Octavia and explained the offer on the table, a modest monthly license fee of £833 covering rent and all utility costs. It was a great deal for a cafe in central London, especially in a space like Coram's Fields, a beloved sanctuary where children played freely and the gates bore the famous sign, "No adult may enter without a child." The park enjoyed steady footfall year-round, with weekend and school holidays bringing a surge of young families and local parents in search of coffee and snacks. Bylan took it on with enthusiasm. Although the cafe had a covered structure, the open sides left customers exposed to the elements. To help her protect her space and her customers, we put her in touch with Barker's Marquees in Godstone, a bespoke supplier who could fit side panels that would match the existing setup. As with any new site, new problems quickly surfaced. Part of our agreement with Coram's Fields included offering staff free tea and coffee, a gesture we'd long upheld at our other sites without issue. But Coram's Fields was different. They had a large on-site workforce. What began as a goodwill gesture quickly became a drain. Dozens of staff were turning up daily for their free drinks, but not buying any food. The takeaway cups alone were starting to chip away at Bylan's margins. Understandably, she was frustrated. Octavia, however, stood firm. "This is what we agreed," she reminded us, unwavering. "We tried to meet in the middle, offering staff 30% off all food in hopes it would encourage them to buy more than just drinks. But it made no difference. They wanted the free coffee, and only the free coffee. To ease the pressure, I arranged for a regular supply of beans from JS Beverages, 6 kilos a month. Based on a 20 grams dose per espresso, that equated to 300 coffees monthly. It was a practical solution, but it only delayed the inevitable." Tensions were rising. Bylin and Octavia clashed repeatedly. Their communication broke down, inch by inch, disagreement by disagreement. What had started as a promising partnership was fraying fast. The final straw came on bonfire night, a major event that should have belonged to Bylin alone. Instead, the organizers brought in external food vendors without warning, hoping to raise additional funds. It blindsided her. For a franchisee who had followed every rule, paid every bill, and weathered each logistical hurdle, it felt like betrayal. It was, frankly, unfair and entirely avoidable. We could sense the strain deepening, the goodwill we had tried so hard to build now slipping through our fingers. And no matter how much we tried to mediate, it became increasingly clear that the arrangement was unsustainable. Sometimes it's not about the coffee or the cost. It's about respect. And when that breaks down, everything else follows. At our Kingston Cafe, things were unraveling. Ben, our trusted team member and son, someone I cared for deeply, was in a bad way. His relationship with Carrie, already strained, was disintegrating before our eyes. They were still under the same roof, sharing a flat with her young daughter Layla, but it was no longer a home. Ben was struggling to function, hollow-eyed and emotionally spent. Work, routine, even basic motivation, he was losing grip on all of it. To keep him steady, I began going to Kingston every day. I set up shop with my laptop, working from the cafe while quietly offering Ben support. I didn't have magic words, but I was there. Sometimes that's all you can offer. Presence, consistency, a kind of quiet witness. At the same time, Adrian and I had just secured the contract for Priory Park, a high-profile, high-footfall site in Raygate. This one was different. We made the call early. We wouldn't franchise it out. We'd run it ourselves, in-house, to maintain full control. And I knew what I had to do. Ben needed out of Kingston. He needed purpose, movement, so I brought him with me. Meanwhile, the question remained, what to do with the Kingston site? Enter Marius. A gelato maker with a sharp eye and ambitious vision, Marius ran Marfoods out of Bicester, paying £10,000 a year for premises that were straining his margins. When he saw our Kingston concession listed at just £3,500 per year, he couldn't believe it. His plan was bold. Make artisanal ice cream on site, serve fresh food and desserts to parkgoers, and use the space as a production base for his wholesale business. But it had to work within our franchise model. We were intrigued. Not only was Marius enthusiastic, but he also made his own gelato, an art form we deeply respected. At about this time, we'd just ended our relationship with Aiden at our Frimley Lodge Park Cafe, and with it, our ability to sell Espies, the ice cream brand from Winston's. That left a vacuum, and an opportunity. We had quickly partnered with Marshfield Farm, a family-run dairy nestled in the hills of Chippenham. They weren't just suppliers, they were kindred spirits. Originally a traditional dairy operation supplying supermarket milk, they had felt the squeeze of corporate competition. Will, the grandson, had taken the reins with his wife Dawn, and together they'd rewritten the farm's destiny. They scaled back to just 200 cows, all fed on organic pasture, and began crafting exquisite ice cream from their own cream. The result was a product we fell in love with, not just for its taste, but for its ethos. Marshfield didn't just offer tubs of joy. They invited our team to the farm to meet the cows, tour the facilities, and see the process from soil to scoop. Dawn and Dan, their rep, even attended our AGM gatherings. They weren't just partners, they became part of our story. But Marius's arrival sparked new ideas. What if we made our own? What if we started experimenting with hyper-local park flavors? Elderflower in spring, lavender in summer, fig in autumn, ice cream as storytelling, tied to the land and the seasons. There was only one catch. Marius had to agree to match Marshfield's pricing. And he couldn't. The volumes, the consistency, the margins, it simply didn't add up. Still, the spark had been lit. Something about the scent of reinvention, the promise of a new chapter, had begun to stir again. For Ben, for us, and for the ever-expanding community we served. Running two new cafes, Raygate and Red Hill, was no small feat. I brought Ben over as our site manager, officially on the payroll. We would co-manage the operations, but I would handle all council liaison directly. I wasn't just overseeing things, I was in the thick of it. Some days I'd be elbow deep in the cafe bustle, others I'd be tucked into a corner with my laptop, handling emails and steering the business from behind the scenes. To make things manageable, I decided to rent a flat locally instead of commuting daily from Grove Park. I found a 3-bedroom place on Bell Street, perched above shops and reachable only via a brutal flight of stairs that felt more like a mountaineering exercise than a stairwell. But it worked. There was a room for me, one for Ben, and a third that simply held our clutter and fatigue. The arrangement was practical, but it pulled me away from Diane. Living in Reigate during the week meant distance, and I felt it. But Ben needed me. He was raw, fragile, struggling with the split from Carrie and her daughter Layla. He was crumbling under the emotional weight. I wanted to keep him close, grounded, and more than anything, away from Lewisham. I knew if he returned, it was only a matter of time before old habits and old demons came calling. I carried a burden of guilt, always had since Sally passed. I'd been consumed by rebuilding my life, by staying upright, and I'd missed the signs that Ben was slipping. I wasn't going to miss them again. Carrie had her own struggles. She wasn't the right fit for him, and while he had escaped the situation, it had left him bruised and alone. Now in Reigate, he had no friends, just me and a cafe filled with strangers. That's why I stayed. That's why I couldn't abandon him. Our Red Hill Cafe, in contrast to the bustling Reigate flagship, was far quieter. We appointed a manager, an assistant manager, and part-time staff. But as history had taught us, hiring staff rarely brought the same drive as handing a business over to a franchisee. Employees complained about being too busy, too overwhelmed, even when the till receipts told a different story. At Reigate, Ben and I ran the cafe like a machine. There were queues snaking out the door from morning till close. The volume was intense, but we held our ground. The profits from Reigate were, in fact, propping up Red Hill. It became clear that something had to give. Adrian and I made the call. Red Hill needed to be franchised out, in line with the pistachios in the park model. Word spread, and soon we heard from Anthony, our Palwell Cafe partner. His daughter Sarah and her fiancé Ben Leslie were interested in taking over Red Hill. Both ex-army, they were now civilians looking to build a future together. Anthony and Rangit at Ben and Sarah's wedding. They'd spent time helping out at Anthony and Ranjit's cafe and loved it. At a personal crossroads, with marriage ahead, they saw the cafe as a foundation, a steady livelihood, a home base, and maybe in time the start of a family. Sarah had trained as an electrician while in the army, specializing in bomb disposal. Ben had the grit and calm resolve of a man who had served. He was eager to work with the community, to roll up his sleeves and make something that mattered. We welcomed them with open arms. They moved into a modest place in Nutfield, just down the road from the cafe. Ben took the reins quickly and impressively. He grasped the pistachios ethos immediately, and with his military precision, he ran Red Hill like a well-drilled unit. He worked alone most days to keep costs lean and handled the lunchtime rush without flinching. It was the first time Red Hill had real energy and focus. Sarah picked up a job with a local electrical firm, but stayed involved on weekends, often baking cakes at home and bringing them into the cafe. It felt like a family business at last, filled with care and sincerity. The following summer, they tied the knot. They held the wedding ceremony in Nutfield and transformed the park into a joyful festival-style celebration where everyone was welcome. The event was so charming it made the local papers. Wonderful publicity for the cafe and a rare moment of community magic. But what came next caught us off guard. Their honeymoon, a 3-week whirlwind across South America, reignited a fire they hadn't realized still burned. Adventure, discovery, movement. When they returned, the routine of cafe life suddenly felt small. Red Hill, the cafe Nutfield, it all began to feel too still. They realized they weren't ready to settle. Not yet. With gentle honesty, they told us they wanted to sell the cafe and set off again, one last big adventure before laying down roots for good. It stung, of course. We'd finally found the perfect pair to breathe life into the place. But we understood. Sometimes the cafe is the dream. Other times it's a stepping stone to one. And so just as we'd embraced them, we wished them well. Back in Raygate, my days blurred between running the cafe and my deeper purpose, being there for Ben. Most evenings after the last coffee was served and the chairs were stacked, we'd retreat to the flat on Bell Street, just the two of us. We'd share a quiet drink, wind down from the chaos of the day, and slowly, Ben began to open up. These were not casual chats. They were raw, heavy conversations, truths that had sat inside him for years, festering in silence. He talked about his depression with painful clarity. He confessed that sometimes the thought of ending his life felt easier than facing another day. He blamed his mom for dying, leaving him. He blamed me too, for not being there enough, for choosing work over time with him. But then, in the same breath, he said he understood. He knew I had to provide. He said he admired me for it, that I was his rock, that despite everything, he looked up to me. He spoke about Diane and Caitlin kindly, said he liked them. But Theo frightened him. Now older, broader, filled with a quiet fury, Theo cast a shadow over Ben that he couldn't shake. That violence, that simmering power made Ben feel cornered, and all he had in those moments was his mouth, sharp, fast, reckless. He knew it got him into trouble. He wished he could control it, but give him a few drinks and a flicker of confrontation, and his tongue would run wild. He couldn't stop himself. Then came the heartbreaks. He reminisced about Jenny, his first real love. She was the one, he said, the kind of woman he could have built a life with. But he messed it up, chasing girls who loved the chaos of parties and the blur of drink. One fling led to betrayal. A friend. A gut punch. Then Carrie arrived. And Layla, her beautiful little girl. He was smitten with them both. He did everything. Fed Layla, changed her nappies, made her laugh. He thought they were building something solid, real. Until she had an affair with the neighbor upstairs. Now he was in a void. Drifting. Wanting love, aching for it, but unsure how to find it again, or whether he deserved it. I listened, helpless. There were no magic words, no fix. So I held him, offered what I could, a hug and a heart wide open. As much as I wanted to stay by his side every night, I also longed to be home with Diane. So I tried to balance it, two nights a week at home, the rest in Reigate. But I knew Ben couldn't stay adrift like this, not indefinitely. He needed more than me. That's when a Facebook post caught my eye. It was Steve, an old friend, practically family. I'd known him since he was a teenager. He once helped us sell toys, did a brief stint with the trailer, and dabbled in Elstree Studios props. And now, years later, there he was, posting a desperate message on social media, asking if any friends had a place for him to stay. He was homeless, just needed somewhere temporary. I read it twice. A thought hit me. Why not here? We had the space. 3 bedrooms. Steve wouldn't need to pay rent. And maybe, just maybe, this could be what Ben needed too. Steve had always been brilliant with the boys when they were younger. He'd perform little magic tricks, show them his pet tarantula or one of his snakes. The boys loved it, especially Ben. Animals, reptiles, Ben had always had that same instinctive connection. It could work. Steve would have a roof over his head, and Ben would have a companion, a kindred spirit. Someone who understood what it meant to live on the fringe. In that moment, the flat on Bell Street didn't feel like a temporary base anymore. It felt like a lifeline, and maybe a new beginning for them both. 2014 was also the year our world shifted on its axis in the most beautiful way. It was the year we became grandparents for the very first time. Our daughter Caitlin, fierce and funny, had found love in the unlikeliest of ways. Through a university connection in Greenwich. Drew was the quiet, thoughtful type, a kind-hearted lad from Ruislip who had been a friend of Callum, the boyfriend of Caitlin's best friend Claire, one of those accidental connections that stuck. By then, Caitlin had stepped away from the familiar bustle of pistachios in the park and was carving her own path, working in insurance out in Ruislip. She and Drew were living modestly in a cramped one-bedroom flat, sharing the space with Drew's dad. It was tight, temporary, and growing tighter. And then came the news. She was pregnant. When she asked if she and Drew could move back in with us at Grove Park, Diane and I didn't need to think twice. Of course we said yes. It felt like something sacred, a new generation beginning under our roof. But in my enthusiasm, I made a classic mistake. I pulled Diane aside and with all the subtlety of a hammer blurted, "I'm happy. Love, really. But I do worry, you being, you know, a bit too hands-on, controlling even. I can see you pushing Drew out." It was like lighting a match in a fireworks shed. Diane didn't take it well, and frankly, I couldn't blame her. But the truth had been gnawing at me. I'd seen it before, her tendency to take over, to direct every detail. And with a baby on the way, emotions were bound to be high. Still, we rallied. Love has a way of softening edges, at least for a while. The young couple moved in, full of dreams and nerves. And then, on October 20th, 2014, after hours of tension, pacing, and 1,000 silent prayers, baby Iris entered the world, red-faced, wailing, and utterly perfect. I wasn't just the grandfather, I became Dede, her shadow, her co-conspirator in life's little joys. When I was home, I'd do the night shifts, change nappies, soothe cries, and sing lullabies in my worst Sinatra. As she grew, so did our bond. We went everywhere together, me and Iris, the cafes, the fun fairs, firework nights, summer parties in the park. She'd ride on my shoulders, sticky with ice cream, clapping at sparklers and carousel music. We were inseparable. I wasn't just Dede. I was her partner in crime. Eventually, Caitlin moved out. It was the natural next step, but when Iris wasn't around, the house felt hollow. I missed the thud of her little feet on the stairs, the chaos of her play, the endless questions that came at 100 miles an hour, and the warm, sleepy cuddles on the sofa. So I started making excuses to visit, and when she couldn't come to me, I went to her. To this day, we still make time for each other. I taught her to swim, and when routine permits, we still meet once a week to glide through the lanes together, laughing, racing, splashing like we're both 5 years old. Becoming a grandfather didn't just change my life, it anchored it. Iris was the calm after the storm, the light after the madness. And every time she calls out my name, I'm reminded some legacies aren't built in cafes or business ventures. Some legacies are built one bedtime story at a time. As the years passed, Iris grew from a wobbly, wide-eyed toddler into a spirited little whirlwind with endless curiosity and a wicked sense of humor. One Christmas, we bought her a bike, and I had the honor of teaching her to ride it, running behind her in the salty sea air of Eastbourne, cheering her on as she wobbled, teetered, and then soared forward on two wheels for the first time. She beamed. I nearly cried. From 2019 to 2023, I was living full-time in Eastbourne. Life had taken another twist. During the pandemic, like everyone else, we were blindsided. Business ground to a halt. I parked my Toyota Hilux on the drive and didn't think twice when Diane canceled the insurance. After all, we weren't allowed to go anywhere. But months later, when Boris and the boys announced that cafes and parks could reopen for takeaway, I jumped into action. Literally. I leapt into the van, desperate to get back to work, to salvage what we could. And in my urgency, I forgot one crucial thing. The van wasn't insured. As luck would have it, I got pulled over. 6 points. A fine. All for an administrative oversight. But the damage was done. Worse still, in the eerie silence of post-lockdown roads, I picked up more points. 3 in Sussex, 3 in Surrey. Not from wild speeding, but for going just over 30 in deserted streets that felt like film sets after the apocalypse. 12 points in total. A full house. And with the courts in limbo, nothing happened, until it did. Just as restrictions began to lift in 2021, the letter arrived. I was banned from driving for 6 months. No car, no van, no visits. For a man who lived behind a steering wheel, it felt like a limb had been cut off. But I wasn't going to sit still. Diane, ever the cheerleader, had recently bought me an electric pedal assist bike as a well-done present for sticking to the lighter life diet. Trouble was, I was still too heavy for the poor thing. The battery wheezed under me like a pensioner on a treadmill. So I upgraded. Found one with a beefier battery and more stamina. That bike became my lifeline. One day, I decided I'd pick Iris up from her mum's and bring her with me to Eastbourne for a couple of days. I had it all planned. Hop on the southeastern train from Eastbourne to London Bridge with my folding e-bike, switch lines to Lewisham, then cycle the rest of the way to Caitlin's. Easy. Iris and I met up and walked hand in hand to the bus stop near Grove Park. She was 7, chatty and bright-eyed, carrying a little rucksack and full of questions as always. The bus pulled up. I folded my bike, tucked it neatly to the side, and stepped forward, but the driver wasn't having any of it. "No bikes," he barked. I tried to explain, as politely as I could, that it folded, that it was smaller than a buggy, that I had a small child with me and just needed to get to the train station. Still no. "But look," I said, gesturing to Iris, "I've got my granddaughter with me." The driver stared ahead like I was invisible. The doors hissed shut. The bus pulled away, leaving a trail of diesel and disbelief. I stood on the curb, speechless, deflated. And then Iris, cool as you like, turned to me with a smirk and said,
"That went well, Dada."
I burst out laughing, proper laughter that cut through the frustration. There we were, stranded, ignored, but together. And honestly, in that moment, I wouldn't have had it any other way. She still makes me laugh like that. And even now, years later, she remains my joy, my teacher, my reminder of what really matters,